You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Barber cited a number of books about time that inspired him, including the classic text by FQXI member Paul Davis, The Physics of Time Asymmetry. Davis is a world-renowned physicist and cosmologist with a long-running interest in the nature of time, and you could read articles about his physics research on the FQXI website. But in recent years, he's turned his attention to a very different puzzle, understanding cancer.
That's right. One of Davis' current roles is as head of the Center for the Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology at Arizona State University. In September, he gave a plenary talk at a medical engineering conference at Imperial College London and described the work that is being done at the center. In particular, he spoke about a controversial theory for the origin of cancer that he has developed in collaboration with an oncologist and an astrobiologist. I caught up with Davis during the busy coffee session after his lecture and asked him to explain what his theory entails and the cancer therapies he recommends based on it. Okay, so thank you very much for chatting to me, Paul, and you've just given a very interesting talk about your unconventional ideas about cancer. So can you just start off by explaining to me how this whole project got started?
I'd never really thought about cancer until I was approached by Anna Barker, the then deputy director of the National Cancer Institute a few years ago. And it's her brainchild to try to bring physicists and other physical scientists into cancer research, not just to help improve diagnostics or treatment, but by lending insights from those disciplines and problem-solving abilities. So I rashly agreed to become involved in this, and to cut a long story short, there were 12 centres set up for physical science and oncology, and I'm running the one at Arizona State University. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. If I'd have known the hard work that's involved, I might have thought twice about it. But actually, it's been a very exciting journey of discovery for me.
But what sort of insight can physicists and other physical scientists offer about cancer when it's something that's been really deeply studied by people that have spent their whole careers, their whole lives studying the biology of it, the biochemistry of it, the genetics of it, dealing with patients, working in the lab? What can you bring to the table that they can't?
Cancer tends to be seen as a human disease for which we must find a cure. But when I come at this subject asking the fundamental questions, as is normal for a theoretical physicist, I see it as a biological phenomenon. It is, of course, a disease that needs to be tackled, but it is a biological phenomenon and a very extraordinary one at that. Because cancer is so common, we tend to take it for granted. Oh, it's that thing that happens. It's actually really bizarre what is going on. It's almost like an alternative way of doing eukaryotic life taking place within the host organism. Because remember that the devastating feature of cancer, the so-called metastatic process, is when cells leave their safe haven, a home in the liver or kidney or wherever they happen to start, and move around the body and find another organ to colonize. What an extraordinary thing to do. And there are many steps involved in that so-called metastatic cascade, and each one requires certain specialized functionality that is normally absent from a cell but gets upregulated or switched on or inappropriately accessed for the cell to be able to go through that pattern of behavior. So here we have a very curious biological phenomenon that is not just found in humans but pretty much across the multicellular world. Even organisms as humble as the Hydra get cancer. So this is something clearly that has very deep evolutionary roots. And so as a scientist working for most of my career on really foundational and fundamental aspects of science, I inevitably ask the questions, well, what is cancer? Why does it exist in the first place? And what are its deep evolutionary origins? And that, of course, if something is deeply entrenched in biology, it must have a use, a functionality. It must be there for a reason, because evolution, if it protects something, means that it's going to have a purpose. Now, we tend to think of cancer as something that kills people, but that's only obviously part of the story. It does that, but there must be a deep reason why evolution hasn't eliminated it. And we think, that is myself and my collaborators, Charlie Lineweaver and Mark Vincent, we think we've identified some of the reasons that cancer is retained as an option in complex eukaryotic organisms like humans.
So you're really looking at cancer from a very different angle. Instead of kind of thinking of it as this terrible disease that comes in and it mutates cells and it damages the body, you're sort of going much further back in time, looking at its kind of evolutionary development and asking, why is it still around now? What benefits does it bring? And how does that help? What benefits does it bring, and why is it important to think about them?
When you look at the genes that are active in cancer, and these have been catalogued over the last few years, you can ask how old are those genes, and what is their normal function? And you tend to find that the cancer genes are very ancient genes. I think everybody recognises that in some sense cancer is a throwback or a reversion to some more primitive type of life form. Sometimes people say, well, cancer behaves like selfish individual cells rather than part of a cooperative. Clearly the story of cancer goes back to the origin of multicellularity, which we think occurred about 1.5 billion years ago, because what's happening in cancer is that ordinary somatic cells in the body are defying the normal regulatory arrangements, which is that they are supposed to undergo apoptosis or programmed cell death after a certain number of divisions. They're switching that off, and they're making a bid for immortality by having uncontrolled proliferation. So it's almost like going back to the unicellular world. But it's not quite that simple, because what you find in a population of cells, usually called a neoplasm, it's a population of cancer cells in the body, is that there is a certain amount of cooperation. That is, cancer is not just individual rogue cells running amok doing their own thing. It is a much more systematic and cooperative process. So it's almost like a very primitive form of multicellularity. We call that metazoa 1.0, as opposed to the more developed metazoa that we see around us. So it's a sort of reversion to an early type of multicellular life, but with less regulatory arrangements. So so the question is, you know, what can you do with that? Well, the first thing is that any good theory has to make predictions, and our theory makes some very specific predictions, because if what we're saying is correct, that cancer is a sort of reversion to an earlier form of life, then we can ask, well, what was the world like at the time that multicellularity first emerged? And one example I can give you is that the oxygen levels were much lower then than they are now. It was a hypoxic world. And sure enough, cancer prefers hypoxic conditions. Cancer doesn't cope with oxygen and oxidative damage very well. And it defaults back to an ancestral type of metabolism called glycolysis, or fermentation, basically, in which it uses a very large amount of glucose, a very small amount of oxygen. So it's another way of metabolizing, making energy. It's far less efficient than the oxidative phosphorylation of healthy cells, but it's very good at making biomass. So it's using a type of metabolism that can is adaptive for proliferation. It can make lots of stuff, but not very much energy. And that's the way life used to do it before the second great rise of oxygen on Earth, which occurred probably about 800 million years ago. So if the evolutionary roots of cancer stretch back before this great oxygenation event, we would expect there to be an interesting story about oxygen, oxygen tension in tissues and metabolism and cancer metabolism. And sure enough, there is. And one of the exciting things here from the point of view of physics and engineering is that for 50 years, cancer treatment has really been stuck in a rut. It's surgery often is the first thing, radiation and toxic chemicals, chemotherapy. You know, this is sort of depressing that when you look at the statistics, you use these traditional methods. There's a little bit of refinement here and there, and one or two conspicuous success stories, but overall, it's really not very good. But this isn't the only weapon in our armory. If it's right, if we're right, that cancer is a reversion to some more primitive phenotype, then we can imagine controlling, maybe not eradicating, but controlling cancer using physical means, physical as opposed to chemical. And oxygen is one example. If we can regulate the oxygen tension in a particular organ or a particular tumour, then this is one way of attacking the cancer, which is not really chemical. It's not physical in the sense of using surgery or radiation. It's another way of doing it, a non-toxic way of trying to combat cancer. So it's one example. There are many others, some involving electric fields and electric potentials. Another that we have been looking closely at is the way the cancer is more vulnerable than healthy cells to infection, that is, disease agents, viruses and bacteria, because in reverting back to an earlier phenotype, cancer is disconnecting from or divesting itself of or being denied the benefits of, depending on how you look at it, more recently evolved capabilities like the adaptive immune system, which is 400 million years old, which is recent in terms of the timescales we're talking about here. And so cancer, it's a two-edged sword. Cancer defends itself against immune attack because it's immunosuppressed. It creates an environment, and again, I'm using loaded terms, creates or finds itself in an environment which the immune system is weakened. And this often occurs by recruiting cells called tumor-associated macrophages, that is, perfectly good macrophages that's supposed to be on the good guys on the side of the organism. They defect to the enemy and become, in effect, a screen that keeps out the immune system and prevents it being attacked. But the cancer can't have it both ways. If the immune system is not going to deal with the cancer, or the cancer is not going to deal with the immune system, then it's vulnerable to infection. And this has been recognized for thousands of years, that tumors can suffer more than the healthy tissue from infection. It's just that infection might kill the patient as well. So there's no point in infecting people and they die of smallpox instead of cancer, for example. But if this is done intelligently, it may be possible to use viruses and bacteria to attack the cancer and stress the cancer more than the healthy cells, which can be protected by the immune system. And so we're working on that as a therapeutic strategy as well.
Let me ask you about those sort of suggested therapies that you've mentioned. With the sort of thinking about the amount of oxygen in the environment, there are tests that have been done, I understand, at least with animals, on the effects of oxygen on cancer. Can you talk a bit about that? And those have been carried out by independent researchers.
The ideal combination is to have low sugar, low glucose, and high oxygen, because the glycolysis, the fermentation mode of metabolism that cancer prefers, requires sugar and doesn't like oxygen. And so if you reverse that, then you would expect the cancer would do rather poorly. And it's really hard to do any cancer experimentation in humans. All sorts of ethical reasons and legal reasons why you can't do this, but mice, you know, always up for grabs. And so these poor mice, I should have to say, a lot of dead mice in this subject. But some recent experiments with mice using a so-called ketogenic diet, which is a low-glucose, high-fat diet, basically, combined with hyperbaric oxygen therapy, so delivering high levels of oxygen tension to all of the organs in the mice, does seem to be very effective in combating cancer. And so we think that this is a good approach to use with humans who may have late-stage cancer that is unresponsive to traditional therapy. Basically, the patients have nothing to lose. It is known, well known in the cancer community, that starvation improves the efficacy of standard chemotherapy or radiation therapy. In other words, starving the patient and starving the cancer makes the cancer more susceptible to damage, finds it harder to repair. But mostly, physicians are going to recommend that you build up your strength for the chemotherapy, which is very debilitating. Ironically, it seems that this is the exact opposite, that just restricting the diet, but better than starving, is to change the diet into this ketogenic form. So that, yes, there's been some preliminary work done, and it's too soon to say, well, this is a miracle cure. I don't think we've heard of miracle cures a lot. We don't need a miracle cure. All we need is to put the cancer under pressure to extend life. We don't have to get rid of the cancer. And that's a message that's very hard to sell. People, they think we're paying all this money. The drug companies ought to come up with a drug that will kill the cancer and make it go away, and we can forget all about it. It's never going to happen. We don't need to do that. We just need to keep the cancer at bay, under control, slow or prevent it spreading, and extend people's lives that way. They're going to die of something else, to put it crudely.
You mentioned, you know, thinking about human trials in the future, and you sort of said, you know, this might be something that would be worth investigating with people that are quite a late stage with cancer and they have nothing else to lose. But from a very naive perspective, as somebody that doesn't really know anything about this, it sounds like treating people with oxygen and changing their diet would be actually much less sort of damaging and have less sort of horrible side effects than many of the treatments that are, you know, being carried out at the moment, radiation and chemotherapy. So why target people at a later stage?
You're absolutely right, and this is entirely political. And I'll give you an example. We work in collaboration with physicians, and I often will ask, why don't you recommend some of these non-standard therapies to some of your patients, where you can say, well, you know, we now sort of run out of options and there's nothing much more we can do, and the statistics say you've got 3 months to live. Go home and enjoy the rest of your life. Why don't you then refer them to some of these alternative treatments like the hyperbaric oxygen therapy? And the answer seems to be that unless there have been properly conducted clinical trials and legal safeguards put in place, this is a minefield. They cannot lend their own personal credibility or that of their institution, their hospital, for example, because if it turns out that this person whose life expectancy might be 3 months dies after 2 months, then they get the blame that they're using some quackery and dragging the good name of their hospital or their institution down. And so that's what we're up against. It is legal problems and ethical problems and the whole issue about proper clinical trials. And the difficulty is that and there's another ugly thing in all this, which is money, because drug companies charge huge amounts for their drugs. They make a lot of profits. If you're going to say to somebody, well, there isn't a drug, it's hyperbaric oxygen, which is used in any case for all sorts of other reasons, then there are financial implications as well, basically. And so there's a huge disincentive, I think, for physicians to just suggest these alternative therapies. Now, in countries like the UK, I guess people are free to do what they want. But the reason that there are no clinical trials is because if nobody's going to make any money out of it. So, and I'll give you another example. Of course, I'm being cynical, but I've become very cynical about this subject because such staggering amounts of money are spent on cancer research that it dwarfs other areas of medical research and certainly other areas of fundamental research. Absolutely huge amounts of money. And so money looms over everything. And if you want to conduct a clinical trial in which you don't make a huge amount of money, well, then it's really hard to get the funding to do that. The other example I was going to mention is aspirin. Aspirin is the best anti-cancer drug we know. There have been clinical trials in Europe that show that it is effective against all of the major forms of cancer, both as a preventative and as a slowing mechanism. And you might think, well, why isn't everybody told about aspirin? You know, why are we talking about $100,000 a year drug treatments when aspirin is being overlooked? And the answer I am told from within the cancer community, well, nobody makes any money from aspirin. You buy it over the counter for a few pounds. It's a story that you'll be told what is correct, but you know, it's not shouted from the rooftops. And so I'm afraid money corrupts everything. And this whole cancer story is, in my view, a bit of a horror story. And that's not to say that the people receiving very large grants are not doing very fine scientific work. Of course they are. But cancer has, when we look at it, $1 trillion or something has been spent on cancer research with not very much impact on these statistics. You really have to ask, here is a very difficult scientific problem. Cancer is a biological phenomenon. It's not well understood. Will we understand it by just throwing money at it? No, we can't spend our way to a solution. We've got to think our way to a solution. That's why it's so important to have people coming in like myself, coming in from the outside, to try to rethink the problem from the bottom up. We've got to just think our way through this. Of course, it needs a budget, but just hurling money at something and just measuring things for their own sake, sequencing genomes, there's a huge amount of sequencing going on, amassing petabytes of data, hoping that some sort of elusive patterns will loom up out of this. It's bound to disappoint. And it's a little bit like doing astronomy, where you think we've got, you know, all these wonderful telescopes. Let's just gather data. We'll point them at the heavens and we'll just sort of amass the data and store it in a computer and some clever person can make sense of it all. You don't do it that way. You have a proper framework, a conceptual framework. It may even be a properly worked out theory, but at least you have a conceptual framework for what's out there, what do we expect, how should we look for it, why is it significant? And then you get your instruments and within, you may be discover something new. It may not conform to your pre-existing ideas, but at least you have a framework for research. In cancer, it's a question of, oh, we can do this. We can measure this. We can do these sequences. We can get all this data. Cells are incredibly complex. We'll keep going like this for 100 years. That's fine. Keep the money coming. We'll do all this stuff. We'll put all this data out there, and some clever person will make sense of it, and then, bump, we've got a cure for cancer. I just think it's pie in the sky.
Well, if sort of the oxygen therapy is thought to be controversial, then the other one that you mentioned is even more so, which is giving people sort of infections in order to target the cancer. And, you know, this is something that you say has a very long history, but it sounds like something that would be very, very difficult to get people to research now. Or am I wrong? Are people researching this in some capacity?
So you're right. This sounds sort of pretty barbaric. Now, one of the things that our theory predicts is that if cancer is a reversion to a phenotype more characteristic of 1.5 billion years ago than to the modern day, then a lot of more recently evolved capabilities in complex organisms like humans should be compromised or jettisoned or divested as part of this reprimitivization of the cancer cells. And one of these capabilities is the adaptive immune system, which is about 400 million years old. So it's ancient by many people's standards, but not ancient by the standards of cancer, which goes back before that. So we think that as cancer progresses, it disconnects, decouples from the immune system. Often that is described by saying that cancer is immunosuppressed. Now, the immune system attacks cancer, and so it's one of the methods that healthy organisms use to defend themselves against cancer. If the cancer is decoupling from the immune system, it can't have it both ways. If it is screened out against the immune system, then it can't be protected from the immune system. And so then the question is whether one can use infectious agents like viruses or bacteria that would selectively attack the cancer, well, would stress the cancer more than the healthy cells. The healthy part of the organism could be more robust or protected by the adaptive immune system. The cancer cells are more susceptible. And it has been known ever since ancient Egypt that tumors will often vanish if the patient gets a serious fever or infection of some sort. And William Cayley at the turn of the 20th century was mystified by the fact that there were less examples of spontaneous remission from cancer as a result of infection since the use of sterilization techniques. So he deliberately infected his patients with some sort of cocktail of infectious agents to induce a fever, and found that there was a therapeutic effect. Now, the standard explanation for that is that if a cancer patient catches a disease, then their immune system is sort of boosted to fight the disease, and maybe the cancer gets knocked off as collateral damage. That's going to be partially true, but we think that the story is that the cancer itself is actually more vulnerable to the disease because it is reverted back to this more primitive form, and so it finds it harder to fight off these diseases. And so selective infection of cancer patients seems like a pretty good way to go, but as you mentioned, there are ethical issues about deliberately infecting cancer patients. So obviously you have to plan a treatment regime rather carefully. But there has been experimentation recently, and in particular with viruses that seem to selectively attack cancer cells as opposed to healthy cells. And so there's a little bit of interest now, I think, in the use of microorganisms to infect cancer. So this is still a bit on the edge of cancer treatment, but it's not totally beyond the pale. And this is alongside the standard immunotherapy work, which aims to basically boost the immune system to try to control cancer in its earlier stages. So I see a complementarity here, that an enhanced immune system is very good in the early stages of cancer. It doesn't do too well in the later stages when the cancer is in an immunosuppressed environment. But the deliberate infection part will work well in late stage cancer. So I see the basis of a whole new treatment regime, which is sort of giving up on man-made chemicals, which is what chemotherapy is, and using instead natural agents like viruses and bacteria to selectively stress the cancer.
Now, you've been talking a lot about your theory and how you think that sort of cancer is some kind of reversion back to an earlier stage in evolution. But it sounds a little bit technical, but I think you have a lovely example that you gave where it was kind of like a computer starting up in safe mode. So can you talk a little bit about that and how, you know, cancer might be triggered, sort of using that analogy?
The standard explanation for cancer is it's reinvented de novo in each organism. If you get cancer and I get cancer, that what happens is that the same disease with the same systematic pattern of behavior is sort of conjured up within the body each time by a sort of fast-paced Darwinism, a dream run of mutations which confer some sort of gain of function on a population of cells. And I've never been convinced by that, and I've never seen the mathematics to support it, that this is really the correct explanation. And to me, what seems much more likely is that, sure, there's some sort of genetic damage which is maybe compromising some of the regulatory arrangements surrounding these cells, but that's just a trigger for cancer. The cancer itself is driven by an ancient, I like to say, genetic program. That's a very simplistic way of putting it. It's not just a cassette of genes, it's a whole set of pathways, genetic and epigenetic, but an ancient core functionality, a little bit like safe mode in a computer, because what's happening there is that the computer suffers some insult or stress, so it defaults back to its core functionality and divests itself of a lot of the more the bells and whistles that are associated with the more sophisticated later additions. And life is like that. We've got lots of sort of little tricks that have evolved over the last few hundred million years. The cancer divests itself of that. It goes back to that ancient core functionality, and it's running on that safe mode. And that provides both a strength and a weakness for cancer. Its strength is that it's protecting its core functionality, which is proliferation. And most treatments target the proliferative prowess of cancer because chemotherapy typically tries to it targets cells that are proliferating rapidly and tries to kill those cells. But you know, life has had nearly 4 billion years to perfect insults through its proliferative ability. So really that's targeting the strength of cancer. What you really want to do is target the weaknesses. And the weaknesses are going to be those things that cancer has jettisoned or has had removed in part of this default back to this core functionality. By running on safe mode, it can't do all these later sophisticated things. And these involve, for example, a whole series of efflux pumps. So didn't have time to talk about this in my lecture, but one of the things that cells have to do is pump out stuff that might threaten them, and that includes chemicals. So chemotherapy struggles against the cell's natural tendency to just pump the toxins right back out again. If cells revert back to an earlier, more primitive form, then a lot of the more recently evolved efflux pumps won't work. And so then the question is, you know, which ones evolved recently? Well, you can tell that by looking at the genes that control these efflux pumps. So we predict that as cancer progresses, it runs on more and more ancient genes, and the more recently evolved genes get downregulated or damaged in some way. We can predict which they are by looking at the ages of the genes. So the key to our theory is looking at the ages of the genes responsible for cancer. Nobody's done this before. No one's concentrated on the ages of the genes. This is a different branch of science. This is phylostratigraphy, and it's of much interest to biologists, evolutionary biologists, who want to know how far back does the common ancestor of this or that. They look at a particular biological function, they want to know how far back you go. So we think that's what you do. You look at the ages of genes, and we would predict, not infallibly, but as a general trend, the more recently evolved genes will be the ones that would be compromised first or switched off first. And that the genes which are upregulated in cancer are these ancient genes, which happen to be the same as the genes that run early stage of embryogenesis. So these are the same genes that create embryos, are creating tumours. These are the ancient genes, the basic body plan that goes back to the dawn of multicellularity, when the whole idea of a body was invented. And so cancer, I mean, I can't stress too much, cancer is a disease of bodies, and bodies haven't always been around. They really date from about 1.5 billion years ago, when multicellularity first evolved. And so that's the context in which we have to understand cancer, that great sweep of evolutionary history. Then we'll get a better handle on it, and then we'll have ways of not only predicting the properties of cancer, which our theory does, but offering us treatment options based on some sort of rational understanding of gene ages and gene regulation.
So now we're really talking about tests of your theory that could be carried out, you know, very soon and quite easily. So are there plans to kind of look into this, to look into gene ages? Is this something that people at your centre are working on, or that you hope other people will be able to look into now?
Yes, the short answer is it's easy enough to test some of these basic ideas just from data mining, because we have the Cancer Genome Atlas, for example, that is telling us which genes are active in cancer. And then we have phylostratigraphic data. That is, we have various databases that look at genes that we have in common with mushrooms and, you know, fruit flies and all that sort of thing, and we can trace back how far back these genes go. In other words, we can put an age on these genes, and these are two data sets that have never been combined together before, and we're trying to do that. Doesn't cost much money. It's a data analysis exercise, and so we're trying to do that. The field is a mess. The Cancer Genome Atlas is all over the place, and even the labeling of the genes can be ambiguous. And so we're trying to sort our way through that. But that's one way that we can go. The experimental tests would, of course, be much more welcome. So we're making predictions about how cancer cells will respond to oxygen, for example, or how their efflux pumps will be up or down regulated. And we would very much like those experiments to be done. It's really hard to get funding in this field. You might think in the cancer industry that has so many billions sloshing around in it, a little bit of money could be found to do some experiments in this these sorts of new areas. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to actually raise funding to do anything non-standard. And one of the depressing features about cancer research is how everyone's following everyone else down the same pathway. Doing anything a little bit out of the ordinary that costs money is a very, very hard thing to do. The other thing that I should say is I come from the world of theoretical physics, where if you have a theory, you publish it, and you expect, if the theory is interesting or any good, that experimental physicists will get attracted to it and will actually do some experiments to test it. And the community works very, very well. It's a model scientific community. And the reason physics is so successful is because there is such good understanding and integration between theory and experiment. Cancer biology is the exact opposite. Nobody, I'm told, is going to rush out to do an experiment to test somebody else's theory. It simply doesn't work that way. So I naively assumed when I started on this, I could come up with ideas, publish them, put them out there, and someone else would find them interesting and do the experiments and run with them. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's very, very frustrating. So unless I can get the money and do the experiments myself or my close colleagues, ain't going to happen.
Now, you're talking there about the difference in culture between sort of cancer research and physics. Just one quick question. I know that you're working very closely with oncologists, but in general, what sort of reaction have you had from the kind of mainstream cancer community to your work? How do they feel about people coming in from the outside and presenting very, very different ideas and very different views?
It's an interesting question because I expected at the outset of this exercise to be pretty much savaged by the mainstream cancer community. Now, I was cushioned somewhat in that the National Cancer Institute had deliberately created 12 centres for thinking outside the box. And the oncologists working within those centres are, of course, fellow travellers. So in speaking to those people, I get a pat on the back. But once you venture outside that rather sort of safe haven, it's a different story. And I think there's nothing irritates a biologist more than a physicist coming into their field telling them what to do. I can afford to do this because I don't have a reputation in cancer biology to lose. So I can be disruptive, and I'm paid to be disruptive, so I make no apology. That's what the National Cancer Institute wanted me to do. They wanted me to come up with some new ideas. I've done that. I think those ideas are well worth pursuing. Behind the scenes, I suspect there's a lot of people who are irritated because this is a very well-funded field, as I've mentioned several times. There's nothing that scares people in a well-funded field more than a suggestion that even some tiny fraction of those funds should be diverted into something which is not the standard paradigm. This field seems to be very conservative, very siloed, even within the cancer community. There are people who don't talk to each other. I've been fortunate in coming in as an outsider. I've been able to take an overview and try to stitch together some of those different fields of research. But it's a very conservative, very siloed community. And when you talk to people off the record, they admit that something pretty drastic needs to be done. Nobody is really doing it. It's a curious thing that in the United States, most of the money spent on cancer research is taxpayer money, whereas in Britain, it's the other way around. The Cancer Research UK is a private, it's a charity. And you might expect there to be a difference in the pattern of research, that a charitable organization would have more freedom to do outside the box stuff. But when I look at the projects being funded on both sides of the Atlantic, they're very similar. And I think, what will it take to have investigation, even some tiny fraction of the budget, an investigation into new areas, not just sort of crackpot stuff that you just dream up out of the blue. Something that has a rational basis, but which is a bit non-standard. What does it take? So there's a powerful lobby group in the United States, the National Breast Cancer Coalition. And I've spoken to them a couple of times. And I said, well, one thing you could lobby for is you take this big budget, $5 billion a year, go to Congress and say 5% of that budget should be allocated for doing this non-standard stuff. 95%. Stick to the same old, same old. But just say, we want 5%. You know, it's a good figure to go for. Give us 5%. I'm told that that is a hopeless cause, even 5%. So it is very frustrating.
Well, on that pessimistic note, I guess, thank you very much. Is there anything else you want to add?
Not really, no. I could go on all day about the politics of this.
That was Paul Davies talking with Zia about the merits of an interdisciplinary approach to fighting cancer.
You'll also find a link to an article about Davies' research that I wrote for Scientific American and his new paper in bioessays on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.